It's Central Time. I'm Cynthia Schuster in for Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we find out what the discovery of a lost J.R.R. Tolkien recording reveals about the beloved Lord of the Rings author's life and thoughts.
First, after 16 years of below average water levels in the Great Lakes, we're finally seeing somewhat of a turnaround, and that could be good news for boaters and shippers.
Thanks to a variety of factors, water levels are on the rise, with Lakes Superior, Michigan, and Huron at levels about a foot higher than a year ago. So what's behind the rising waters, and will the trend continue?
Joining us now to talk more about this story is Erin Coy. She's the O'Brien Fellowship intern at Milwaukee Journal Sentinel, where she's been covering the Great Lakes. Erin, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure. Well, water levels are up in the lakes. How big of a rise have we seen? We've seen a foot in the last year, but how does that compare to, say, the last decade?
The last decade, we've been down. This might not sound like a big number, but jump at least. We've been down since 1998 at about 579 feet, and then now we're back to 709 feet, but about 2 years ago, it was about 577, which 2 feet doesn't seem like a lot, but it's, to put it into inches, 12 to 24 inches is a lot for the Great Lakes.
Yeah, and what accounts for that? Why are we seeing rises this year?
Well, this year we're in particular seeing rises because of all the ice that's been on the Great Lakes. Over 90% of the lakes this year were covered in ice, which is the second highest on record. And plus this early spring and into the summer, we've had about 18 inches of rain. That's mostly in the southeastern Wisconsin area, but it's probably pretty similar around the Great Lakes.
And as I understand it, having so much ice, which covered about 92% of the Great Lakes, has helped stave off water evaporation, but also cloud cover is a factor here, too. How has cloud cover been a factor?
Yes, yes. According to one of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration researchers, he told us that for about 12 years now, there's been some low cloud coverage over the Great Lakes, which means more water is being evaporated and more water is moving out than is actually coming in. So that's been a huge factor in low lake levels.
And what will this mean for the way in which we have been using the Great Lakes? As I understand it, there may not be as much dredging necessary.
Yeah, we've had a lot of dredging for shipping canals, especially coming through the St. Lawrence Seaway into the Great Lakes, up through the Sault Ste. Marie locks into Lake Superior. There's had to be dredging done for the last few years to deepen those canals. This year we shouldn't have any deepening, mostly just maintenance and marinas for dredging, and that's about it.
And what does this mean for the local economy as far as the shipping industry goes?
Well, it means that ships can start carrying heavier loads. In the past few years, they've had to cut back on cargo loads because of that draft issue with the shallower waters. But now they can bulk up their loads again and start carrying more cargo in and out of the Great Lakes, which obviously increases our local economy. So that's a huge plus, but we don't have any solid numbers on that yet.
In what ways will we start to see the impact of that shift in the local economy through the increase of the shipping industry?
One of the biggest cargoes coming in and out of the Great Lakes is grains. Like I said, I don't have any numbers on that, but we'll definitely see some more heavier loads coming in and out, which means it's a beneficial factor towards the grain economy, especially in Wisconsin, because that's one of our biggest exports.
And I know the future is hard to predict here, but what do you foresee in terms of the Great Lake level measurements going forward, either in the next year or beyond 5-10 years?
Yeah,
will it continue to depend on the weather?
It will definitely continue to depend on the weather. Great Lakes levels are very cyclical, so they go up and down every year. Depends, like I said, on the ice temperatures and the rain we get throughout the year and the evaporation. But right now, I know that forecasted through August and into the fall, levels are supposed to remain above average. I don't really know predictions 5-10 years in the future. But again, cyclical patterns have shown that this will continue to happen, this deep dive and then returning to normal.
So would you classify this as good news, or could you even say it's is not necessarily bad news, but it is cloaked in a greater conversation about the way in which the weather has impacted the state of Wisconsin in the last year between polar vortexes and some other strange weather phenomena. Yeah. So what does that mean in the bigger picture of things?
I can't say definitely, but I know if we have more winters like we have the last year, not necessarily the polar vortexes, but if we have this continued very decent ice cover across the lakes, levels I think will definitely remain above average. I'm not an expert on the levels, obviously, so I can't guarantee that, but the cyclical nature of it is if we continue having winters like the last couple years, then we'll be good.
Mm-hmm. And what do you continue to look out for as you continue to work with and research the Great Lakes?
Well, we have a couple big stories coming up, not necessarily on lake levels, but the Great Lakes are a big news lately, especially with the shipping industry and the invasive species that are happening. So in the next couple of weeks, next month or so, we'll have some big stories coming up on the Great Lakes.
Great. And as you look at this story specifically, is it possible that things will return to us? I know that you said you're not quite sure what normal is supposed to be. Is that because we've seen levels that are below average and above average, and we don't really have a sense of what's normal anymore?
Yeah, I think that is a sense. I mean, I grew up on the Great Lakes my entire life, so I've seen fluctuating waters since I was a kid. So I don't know what's normal. I don't know if anyone now knows what's normal, especially with the deep dive last year to being a record low, coming back up almost 2 feet this year, 1 to 2 feet this year, and being back above average, which is a huge jump.
Mm-hmm. Well, Erin, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Erin Coy has been covering the Great Lakes for the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel.
And we'd like to hear your experiences of the Great Lakes. If you have property on the lakes, been vacation, been swimming, do you see higher water levels this year? Have you seen low water levels in previous years? How has that affected your life? Or if your livelihood depends on the lake levels. Like to hear from you, too. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR, send us a message on the Central Time Facebook page, or email talk@WPR.org. Middle Earth fans have long speculated about the real meaning of The Lord of the Rings and whether its author, J.R.R. Tolkien, in fact, maybe saw himself as a bit of The Hobbit.
A lost Tolkien recording discovered over 20 years ago but kept under wraps until recently is shedding light on some of the mysteries surrounding Tolkien and shows a rarely seen side of the beloved fantasy author.
With us now is Noble Smith. He's a self-proclaimed Tolkien nerd and author of The Wisdom of the Shire and Sons of Zeus. He blogs about all things Tolkien at shirewisdom.com, and he's one of a few people who has heard this rare recording so far. Noble, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Well, tell us the story of this lost Tolkien recording. Where did it come from? When did it surface?
Well, Tolkien had this wonderful party that was put on for him in 1958 in Rotterdam. And it was the only party of its kind. It was a Hobbit festival. And he went there and he got off the boat and he kind of did a pub crawl before he got to the party, so he was a little bit in his cups by the time he started speaking, which is great because he sounded just like Bilbo before he gave his big 111st birthday speech, this famous scene from The Fellowship of the Ring. And so anyway, a lot of people, this talk was sort of legendary. But there was no transcript of it, and there was just a little portions of his speech in his notes that his son came into possession after he died. So nobody really knew what he said for sure. So about 20 years ago, this guy named Rene Van Rossenberg track down the man who was in charge of recording things at this hall in Rotterdam, and found the old magnetic tapes in an old kind of moldy box in his basement.
And he held on to it for a while. If I can make a Lord of the Rings Hobbit analogy, it was his precious. He didn't want to share it with the world quite yet.
He did. He said that he was like Smaug the dragon. He sat on it for about 20 years. And then he was going to, I think he was going to sell it to the BBC, but some Middle Earth fanatics found out about that he was in possession of it, and now it's sort of owned by the Middle Earth Network, which is a group of people in the United States, and what they want to do is clean up the recordings and make them available for the public.
So you've heard this. We can't hear it quite yet. Do they have an ETA of when the public can give a listen?
I think it'll probably be sometime in the fall. They're going to do a Kickstarter campaign, and you can learn more about it at mymiddleearth.com.
And now you have listened. You're a huge fan of J.R.R. Tolkien. What did you take away from his speech at his, well, it wasn't really his 111st birthday, but it was like that.
Yeah, I'm a huge fan, and I wrote this book called The Wisdom of the Shire, which is kind of how to live like a hobbit. And the guy who runs the Middle Earth Network, or one of the people that runs it, a guy named Mark Ostley, had read my book. And he loved it and loved the kind of message. And when he heard this Tolkien recording, the Rotterdam recording, he was blown away. And he said that I had to hear it because the message that Tolkien delivers in this speech was essentially the message of my book. And so when he sent me a music file that I just downloaded to iTunes, and I listened to it, and of course, welled up with tears, and it was just so beautiful. First of all, to hear Tolkien's voice, kind of in a way that nobody has ever heard him before, very jovial and just cracking jokes and talking, referring to everybody in the audience as my dear hobbits, and the message of his speech is incredibly deep.
And what is that message?
Well, that the hobbits of the world need to stand up and fight against the Sarumans who are taking over the world. And if you've read the books, you know that Saruman is the evil wizard who, at the end of the books, kind of invades Hobbiton and corrupts it and tries to destroy the Hobbit way of life. So what's so amazing about this is 1958, okay? And already Tolkien, who is sort of like one of the modern environmentalist. I mean, he whenever he saw pollution or industrialization run rampant, he called it orcery. He hated it. He thought it was like a product of the orcs. And he hated to see trees cut down. I think one of the reasons he wrote The Lord of the Rings was out of this profound love of trees. And that's reflected in the Ents. But he also states what he believes is the theme of The Lord of the Rings. And you're just going to have to wait until the recording comes out, because I can't spill the beans on that yet, or I'll get in big trouble.
But the gist is, and people have read this message, and I think you pointed out in your book, this questioning that of the idea that progress is always good, that technology is always good, and questioning of authority and the corrupting influence of power. It seems like that is a key theme that people have taken out of The Lord of the Rings. Did you get that feel from this speech?
Oh, yeah. Tolkien, in his letter, says that he hated the fact that the men with mustaches and bombs were ruling the world. And, you know, if you kind of imagine the sort of Victorian-looking guy with the big handlebar mustaches and, you know, a giant ship, you know, heading off to blast some poor country into oblivion, he despised that. And he had gone through World War I, had caught trench fever in the front lines. So many of his friends were dead by the end of this war. And there are reflections of that in The Lord of the Rings. But he really wanted people to stand up. In one of the final chapters of the Fellowship of the Ring, or the Lord of the Rings, is a chapter called The Scouring of the Shire, and it's about how the hobbits come back to the Shire and they defeat Saruman. And one of the things they do is they find that he's imposed all of these ridiculous rules. And so the hobbits see the rules, you know, posted into these guardhouses, and they just rip them off the wall and tear them in half. That's how they felt about that.
An inspiration for the anarchist everywhere, in a way.
And Tolkien himself joked that he was sort of an anarchist.
Well, it seems like, I mean, the whole or most of Lord of the Rings is the confrontation with Sauron, this ultimate evil, you know, nothing good, super powerful thing. Tolkien says, okay, yeah, we got rid of that. But these pettier evils, these more mundane evils are the ones we got to watch out for here in the real world.
Oh, yeah. I mean, you look at some of the minor characters in the story, like Grima Wormtongue, you know, the horrible... lackey to Saruman, who corrupts Theoden, and Saruman himself, who was supposed to be a great and high-minded Astari wizard, but he too was corrupted by this quest for power. And the things that he does in Hobbiton, when Saruman moves in, he does things like builds factories that just belt smoke into the air. Nobody knows what they actually make. And, you know, a lot of times I think that we've lost our connection to the earth. And in the beginning of The Lord of the Rings, Tolkien says that the hobbits had this deep and abiding connection with the earth. And I think that's something that we can strive to kind of recapture.
Getting back to the setting of this speech that we're going to hear a recording of later this year, if Tolkien were a fantasy author today, he'd be expected to do this hundreds of times a year at conventions around the world. How unique was an event like this for an emerging rock star of the emerging fantasy genre?
Yeah, that's a great point. I mean, it was a one-off. I mean, he never did it again. And he hadn't done it before this. I mean, it was a real thrill for him to be there. To see all there was a menu there was hobbit food, and it was kind of hilarious because they had things like vegetables of goldberry and egg salad a la Barleyman Butterbur and maggot soup, which was named after one of the characters, Farmer Maggot,
but not literally with maggots, hopefully.
Yeah, it doesn't sound very good, but he loved it. He had so much fun and wrote about it in his letters about what it.
Noble, are you still there?
I'm still there, yeah.
Okay. And so one thing I wanted to ask, did Tolkien think of himself as kind of a hobbit come to life?
He did see himself as a hobbit come to life. He really did. I mean, it was, he said that he was a hobbit in everything but stature. He loved the countryside, and he loved gardening, and hanging out with his friends and smoking his pipe and drinking and eating good food and being with his family. And he really was like a hobbit. And when you hear this recording, you'll just be blown away at how similar he sounds to Bilbo.
And he reads, you write a poem in Elvish. What was it like to hear the creator of this imagined language, read a poem in that language?
Oh, yeah. It's just gorgeous to hear. He had such a mellifluous, beautiful voice. People who took his classes said that he could turn a lecture hall into a mead hall, which means, you know, fun and excitement. And, you know, he would make language come to life. He was a philologist and loved words. So when he reads this in Elvish or speaks it in Elvish, he sounds like one of the elves. And then he translates it into English, which is great. And if you go to my article in the Huffington Post, you can actually read the English version.
Well, Noble, thank you so much for joining us. And when this audio is available, maybe we can hear that Elvish poem on the air. Thanks again for joining us.
Hey, thank you.
That was Noble Smith. He's the author of The Wisdom of the Shire, talking about some recordings of J.R.R. Tolkien that'll be out later this year. How do boys learn to act like boys? Is it something that just comes naturally? Or is there a process of learning, of socialization, that leads boys to follow along with stereotypically male behavior?
Our next guest is looking to answer those questions, and she sees a big transition in the 4 to 6 year old age range as boys start to learn how to fit in with their peers.
Judy Chu joins us now. She's affiliated faculty in the program in human biology at Stanford University. Her new book is When Boys Become Boys: Development, Relationships, and Masculinity. Judy, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, what, first of all, are the boy-like behaviors that we're talking about when we say things like boys will be boys?
I think usually parents and teachers are prompted to make that comment when boys act in ways that are rowdy or rambunctious, kind of that boy energy of being kind of frisky and out there and running around in large groups. That's usually when adults are tend to respond, mm-hmm. look at the boys being boys.
Well, you wanted to find out where that and other behaviors come from. You followed a group of boys for 2 years, starting at age 4, and while each boy had his own personality, what were some of the common themes you saw from the beginning at age 4, at the beginning?
I think that one of the more common things, it's not so much a specific behavior that they would display, although one of the things that they definitely bonded over was an expressed interest, for instance, in gunplay. Mm-hmm. And so whether or not the boys individually felt inclined to play with guns, they soon learned to say that they did like guns very much, because that was a very fast way to kind of bond with the other boys and have something in common that they could talk about and play and do their make-believe. It was more so in terms of the transition or the changes that I started to see as they, started to appear like quote-unquote boys. It was more about kind of becoming more constrained, being more careful about what they displayed. So whereas they had been very open and kind of honest, kind of wearing their hearts on their sleeves and just saying what they thought and felt in any given moment, it was more a transition towards becoming a little more strategic and a little more savvy, beginning to be more self-conscious in the sense that they were more worried about how other people might respond to them, if they were to express, for instance, an interest in dolls.
And now you talked to this group of boys over time and you tried to ask them and figure out what was leading them to change their behaviors. What kind of things did they say about why they didn't wear their heart on their sleeve anymore?
I think a lot of it was a concern about or a desire to fit in with the other boys, to connect with them in ways. They really wanted to kind of be one of the boys and with the boys. So this idea of wanting to identify as one of the boys as opposed to being one of the girls, or by default, one of the girls in the class. And the other thing was just being able to relate to the other boys, to have things in common, to be able to play with them and spend time with them. And so with that goal, they were learning like what's appropriate behavior, what's desirable, and learning to align themselves with those norms that were appearing within their peer group culture and that also reflected kind of the larger norms, the broader norms in our society that our society has for boys in general.
Yeah, I was going to say it's there in the peer group, but where are these guys as a group getting these messages? Is it media, parents, everywhere? I don't know.
I think it's kind of everywhere. I mean, obviously there are some parents that, different parents have different preferences, and so some of them thought, gunplay is completely appropriate for boys this age, and they were okay with it. Other parents were very cautious and didn't really want their boys to play with guns. And so what would happen is when you get a group of kind of boys from different families with different values, the ones, who maybe aren't exposed to guns in the household, and I don't mean like real guns, but just kind of guns being okay, they would pick it up from their peers who maybe had, access to media or to messages that they weren't, that the boys weren't hearing in their own homes, if that makes sense.
And did the boys cite these things? Are they aware? I saw on TV or in this movie or my mom and dad said, do they have citations for this kind of behavior?
Well, they would talk about, like, for instance, one of the boys who was kind of the leader, he was taller, he was kind of more aggressive and more assertive. He would come in and say, I saw this rated R movie over the weekend, and there are these guys, and the bad guys, they had these guns. And the other boys were, of course, kind of enthralled and kind of just like, what's going on, and what is this about? And in part, even the leader, it was a little bit, the blind leading the blind, because he didn't know completely how to make sense of it. But he was kind of figuring that out by talking to his buddies about it. And what his buddies were picking up were like, oh, this is something kind know, interesting and maybe exciting. And obviously the parents, you know, or the teachers would respond in a way that made it even more interesting because they weren't really supposed to be talking about it. And so then they'd kind of try to hash that out. But because they're all 4 years old and don't have more information, they weren't always getting the most accurate picture of what was going on.
Are they, and this is hard maybe to see from the outside, how much are they taking this in and really internalizing it at this stage? Or, and how much of this is posture, you know, acting, trying on what they perceive a male role to be?
I think the word that you use, posturing, is a perfect description of what's going on. A lot of times it seemed that they were learning to posture before they really understood what it was all about. And so the whole obsession or the focus on gunplay actually kind of petered out, because that was the year that the Jonesboro shootings happened in Arkansas. And when the boys saw and found out what guns could actually do, they actually became really frightened, and they abandoned their gunplay because they hadn't been thinking of it in violent terms. They had thought of it as, this is something we kind of do together. It's exciting because the teachers and parents don't appear to disapprove, but, you know, we can sneak around together and do it. But when they found out that guns actually hurt other people and could hurt children, and could, you know, they really didn't want anything to do with it after that. I mean, and so they changed to other things. They changed to sports. They changed to, you know, kind of baseball cards, things like that, other ways to bond that were kind of, that could still be, that were still kind of considered masculine ways of bonding, especially sports, you know, but without the violent edge that they had kind of been shocked by when the Jonesboro shootings happened.
How much of this, what they're trying on as masculine behavior, is really defined consciously as being not what the girls do?
Oh my gosh, so much of their masculinity, especially at that age, is defined exactly in opposition to what the girls are doing. So when they, the boys actually created a team called the Mean Team, which they described as, you know, being created by the boys for the boys for the purpose of acting against the girls. So it was kind of a boys against the girls, but it also became very apparent that this was a way for them to define themselves in opposition to the girls. So they, when I spoke to the two boys who had began, you know, kind of created the Mean Team, they said, at first we thought it could be the nice team, but actually the girls are the nice team, so we had to be the Mean Team. So a lot of their self-concept in terms of masculinity was very much, you know, whatever the girls aren't, that's what we need to be. So defining themselves as the opposite or as being very different from girls and femininity.
And how much do the boys police each other's behavior, watch for the thing that goes outside that is too unboy-like or too girl-like?
They police each other a lot, even at this young age. I mean, the way that the Mean Team was structured, there was actually a boss of the Mean Team, who was that, his pseudonym was Mike. And Mike actually had the power to exclude people, because you could be fired from the Mean Team. And if you were fired from the Mean Team, by implication, you were no longer a boy, and you were by default a girl. And so there definitely were, you know, rules to be followed, rules that kept, you know, all the boys had to do this. And if you didn't do this, if you were, for instance, friends with the girls, you were at risk for being fired from the Mean Team and losing your status as a boy.
Are the boys just passively receiving messages from each other, from the world, about what it means to be a boy? Or are they pushing back sometimes, actively negotiating, trying to expand boundaries where they can?
They're absolutely active participants in their socialization. I'm really glad you brought that up, because there is definitely evidence of their resistance, a healthy resistance against both the messages that they're hearing that don't kind of mesh with what they feel about themselves or what they know about themselves, and also a resistance just against conformity. At that age, you get a lot of, you know, I don't have to do that. You can't tell me what to do. You're not the boss of me. And so that definitely comes up against this wall that they're approaching that says, okay, boys have to do this, but on an individual level, they don't like to be bossed around. They don't like to be told what to do. And so seeing them kind of struggle with that and negotiate that and having to kind of reconcile, or learning how to reconcile, you know, how to be a part of the boy group, how to fit in, while also maintaining their own sense of getting to do what they want and preserving their integrity in that sense.
At the end of the 2 years, a lot of people talk about, you know, boys being less emotionally connected, worse at relationships. Where did the boys you were working with stand after that period when it came to expressing emotions and expressing relationships with one another?
That's a great question. I think that what happens is, as they become more strategic and savvy, their relational capabilities and desires, what they're able to know, what they're able to do, and the fact that they want to have meaningful connections with others becomes less apparent because they don't wear their hearts on their sleeves anymore. They don't kind of just come out and say it. But they don't lose those capabilities. The capabilities kind of go underground. They become more difficult to detect, but they definitely persist. And I also did, prior to my study of younger boys, I studied adolescent boys, and I definitely saw evidence in their interview narratives and in my observations of them in their everyday interactions with peers and adults that those capabilities are still there. They don't disappear or get lost, but they do become less evident.
We're talking to Judy Chu. She's the author of When Boys Become Boys. In just a couple minutes, we're going to follow up on that last point and talk about what might get lost when those abilities, those emotional relationship abilities and desires are there, but intentionally suppressed. She's in her book, she makes the case that boys learn the behaviors we consider masculine around the ages 4 to 6.
And you can join the conversation. Do you see boys changing their behavior around kindergarten age, learning how to act like a boy and not like a girl, as we understand those terms to be? Do you think there are built-in natural differences in the way boys and girls behave, or do they pick up those differences along the way? You can call in now at 1-800-642-1234. That's 1-800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We continue our conversation with Judy Chu, author of When Boys Become Boys: Development, Relationships, and Masculinity. In her research, she sees boys learning to fit in with their masculine social norms around age 5, and a lot of those behaviors are learned, not built in by nature.
You can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Are you a parent or a teacher? You see this happening all the time in front of you. What kind of changes do you see, say, between ages 4 and 6 in the way boys act and interact? Call 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll get your calls in just a moment. But Judy, just a few moments ago, you said, you know, boys don't lose these emotional interests, these relational interests, or even necessarily abilities, but they kind of hide them to fit in. What's the damage? What's the problem with that?
It's a difference. They basically learn that there can be a discrepancy between what they know and what they show. And what happens then is when they show less of what they know, people can underestimate what they know because they say, oh, well, boys can't do this, or they're not interested in, you know, they're out of tune or just not interested in relationships, out of touch with their own emotions, and they get definitely underestimated, and their relational capabilities go unacknowledged, at least in the literature on boys and also in their everyday lives. And that can be, you know, to boys' disadvantage, because people then treat them as though they don't know these things or they don't want these things. And then they can, you know, it just creates a cycle where they learn that, oh, well, this isn't something that I can share with other people, when those connections are something that they continue to seek throughout their lives. I mean, just kind of connections in which they can feel truly known and accepted. Unless they're able to share themselves with at least a select few, they can feel very lonely, and that can be very difficult, especially as they continue through adolescence and into adulthood.
We'll go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We've got Jack on the line in Kenosha. Jack, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for a good show. I'd like to ask the guest if she's familiar with the research done by the Discovery Channel and Discovery Magazine. They've been doing it for decades. One of the things that they found is that in boys and girls, the degree of masculinity or femininity in either sex is really determined pretty much in utero, and it's determined by different things, but oftentimes by chemicals that are used by the mother, and they determine, you know, whether, for instance, a young boy, I have a friend of mine, her young son was very quiet, very gentle, loved to read and fish, as opposed to, I knew a lady who had a little boy who was 3 or 4. She literally had to keep on a leash. This kid was the ever-ready bunny. He'd fallen out of the second floor and just kept on going. You have these extremes. And my comment about this is, until we begin to understand that and honor that, as well as honoring differences in sexual orientation, et cetera, we're really doing harm to people to expect people to all be the same and to fit into, you know, one nice square little box.
Jack, thank you so much. That brings up a lot of issues. Judy, where do you want to run with that?
I'm so glad you brought up that point, because I think it's a fantastic point, and I agree entirely. I mean, that definitely there are more individual differences than between group differences. And so that's one of the things that people tend to not consider when they talk about, oh, boys do this and girls do that. Well, the differences among individual boys, as Jack pointed out in his examples, can oftentimes be greater than the difference between the average boy and the average girl. And so it really doesn't make sense to kind of pigeonhole people based on their sex or gender, because there can be a lot of other things that contribute aside from, you know, their mere sex and gender, their backgrounds, their family backgrounds, and their communities, and their race and ethnicity, and all those things can contribute, or even their individual temperaments and personalities definitely can shape more who they are than their simple category of sex or gender.
And Judy, you write that your own son was that quieter kid who didn't want to do the boisterous, rowdy boy stuff. How difficult is that situation, that kindergarten era, for somebody who doesn't want to do the traditional or stereotypically whatever boy stuff?
Right. My son was tended to be shy and quieter and didn't want to run around with, you know, he said that, you know, the other boys play a little rough and he'd rather just sit out. And actually, at the school that he was at the time, unfortunately, they found that shyness and sensitivity in boys was a problem. And they would meet with us and tell us, you know, how problematic this was and that we needed to help him change and help him to kind of come out of his shell. And luckily, because I had done this work, I felt a little more confident staying with the idea that this was okay and just to let him write it out. And these days, he's, you know, a little less shy. He's still very sensitive, but he definitely enjoys being with his peers. And he just kind of needed to come out on his own schedule and not when people wanted him to be rowdy and rambunctious at that time. And so just kind of respecting each of our boys' own, again, like Jeff pointed out, like their own personalities and temperament, and trying to meet them where they are and then helping them to move ahead and develop in the ways that will foster their own strengths, their individual strengths, and help them to kind of, you know, come into themselves in the ways that they feel comfortable.
Jack, thanks a lot for the call. We'll go now to Eva in Algonquin, Illinois. Eva, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
I wanted to bring up that, you know, in the earlier years when the kids have structure and then they go with their siblings, and that seems to be easier just from what I've experienced. And I work with pediatrics, so I find that with the adolescents, the trouble comes in with the bullies. Mm-hmm. It seems that when the boys are being bullied later on in life, or depending on their circumstances, it seems that they become more aggressive and more depressed.
Eva, thanks a lot for the call. Sounds like you were starting to break up a little there. Bullying, Judy, are you seeing that as early as 4 to 6?
Unfortunately, that does seem to be coming in at early ages these days. I know that the school my son was at, they had a big bullying problem in the first grade, which feels early as a parent, but definitely was coming in with the taunting and just kind of this one-upping competitive environment that the boys create for themselves because they feel compelled to have to prove themselves to their peers. And it's definitely a problem, and as Eva was starting to mention, it can lead to at least, you know, either aggression or have kind of feigned aggression and depression when they're feeling like they can't connect with other people and that their environments aren't safe.
Is bullying a big part of the story we're telling here? The bullies themselves are trying to display what they perceive as appropriate male behavior, and the people being bullied are those who don't conform to that?
I think that it's complicated. I think that in my book, Mike, who was the leader of the mean team and would oftentimes definitely appeared to be the bully. He would order other people around, boss other people around, and definitely had more aggressive tendencies. But if you look at his case study, you also understood that in many ways he felt very vulnerable. He was very vulnerable and scared of being abandoned, and that was why he had kind of wanted to create this team in the first place, so that he could punish anyone who wanted to try to leave him. And so I think each of the boys is trying to strive towards an image that they think will protect them and help to ensure the relationships that they want. They're trying to stay connected both to other people and to themselves. And in the way that their socialization is set up, you know, kind of emphasizing these masculine norms that emphasize physical toughness and emotional stoicism and self-sufficiency as the pathways to success, those are not serving them well in their quest to kind of have these relationships in which they feel known and accepted.
Well, looking at the research you did and the research that's out there, what kind of lessons can we start to draw for parents and teachers?
I think that in general, I usually suggest to parents and teachers who are looking to support boys, first of all, to acknowledge boys' relational capabilities as something that's healthy for boys, that's something that's going to be, you know, conducive to their overall health and also their success in terms of feeling connected to other people, feeling whole in themselves, getting to know themselves and feel validated in that sense, but also not necessarily pushing any one behavior or another. So my suggestion is not that we replace the traditional masculinity list with some other list that we decide for now is more valuable or better. Like, when we don't want to change, you know, replace the masculine, you know, the macho man with a sensitive man, but more so with an emphasis on fostering boys' awareness, their self-awareness, their conscientiousness, and there's critical self-reflection, so that sometimes if they hear messages that aren't consistent with what they know to be true of themselves or of their relationships, that they're able to kind of say, this doesn't sound quite right to me, and I feel confident enough to not feel compelled to kind of conform to these expectations that don't fit me correctly, that feel uncomfortable for me. So helping boys to stay in their comfort, in their own comfort zones, and therefore be, you know, quote unquote, true to themselves, and to find relationships that will support those efforts.
Is it fair to say, maybe look toward, whether you're raising boys or girls, look for human qualities to promote rather than worrying about the male or female qualities?
Exactly. That's exactly right. And just to kind of, I think there's, Terry Real said that, you know, when we take the whole range of human qualities and we divide them into masculine and feminine, and we say that only boys should be quote unquote masculine and only girls should be quote unquote feminine, that everyone loses, because actually a lot of these qualities are human strengths, are things that will serve everyone well. And so if you can help them to be true to themselves, whatever that may be, and there will be, and to also account for individual differences, the fact that everybody does have different, you know, some people are more outgoing, some people are more shy, some people are more gregarious, and to kind of really figure out what each person's strengths are and help them to develop those in what ways you can, that's how we can better support our kids.
Judy, thanks for joining us today.
Of course, thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure.
That was Judy Chu. She's affiliated faculty in the program in human biology at Stanford University and author of When Boys Become Boys, Development, Relations, and Masculinity. If you have some more thoughts on this conversation, share them over at the Central Time Facebook page.